This is the Dealer News Today podcast, the podcast for automotive executives and the professionals who support them.
Well, hey there, folks, and welcome to Dealer News Today. And look at you. You're here. I'm here. And you know what? I hope you're having a glorious day. And if you aren't having the best day, remember, you got to always try and find the good. It's there. I promise. Trust me, you just got to find it. So that's my word of wisdom, words of wisdom for the day. So this is episode 9 of season 6. Can't believe it. Moving right along. But we have so many great past guest interviews throughout the seasons that you could listen to anytime on demand. You just go to dealernewstoday.com or look up the show on any of the podcast platforms because we are on all of them. That's right. And of course, follow the show at Dealer News Today on social media. And hi, I'm your host, Derek D. And if you'd like to find out more about who I am, you're like, who's this Derek D guy? DerekD.com is where you do that. All right, so let's talk about our guest on today's episode. He's an extremely well-educated fellow, speaks multiple languages, and he's got a PhD in finance. So he knows his stuff. Please welcome the senior partner at McKinsey & Company and co-founder of the McKinsey Center for Future Mobilities, Dr. Philip Kampshoff. Philip, thanks for coming on D&T.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you got it. You know, it's funny because for a while there, we were playing like a scheduling tag for a little bit where we're trying to get you on.
Yeah.
Yeah, so glad we finally got you here.
Crazy times in the industry.
Yeah, I'm sure. You seem you're a very busy guy. So where... you're originally from where, Germany?
Yeah, originally I was born in Munich, and that's where I grew up and then went to college. And then about 10 years back, I came here to the U.S.
Right. So you, and I think I read you speak German, English, and Spanish. Any other languages you speak to?
No, this is it.
That's it. That's pretty awesome. I speak one. I can get by with Spanish, but that's about it. So you're based in Houston, Texas, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And is the company mainly based there? Or
Well, McKinsey is a global company.
Global, yeah.
The city that comes closest to our headquarters would be New York, but we do have offices basically in all major cities around the globe.
Right. Yeah, you're a pretty big company. What made you end up in Texas and not New York?
That's a very long story. ultimately, I think. After becoming partner in Germany, my wife and I decided we weren't quite ready to settle in Munich. We wanted to go out and see more of the rest of the world. And I was asked by McKinsey to come over to the U.S. and help further grow and build our automotive practice here in the U.S. And my wife is a lawyer, and she had a chance to work in Houston. So it worked out really well for us, for both of us.
Oh, that's that's cool. I mean, and how long have you been there?
Almost 10 years now.
Okay, so yeah, it's been a while. So you live in Houston, Texas. Your wife's a lawyer. You study business in Singapore, Argentina, and Germany, right? And you have a PhD in finance. And you've been with McKinsey & Company for over 10 years, right?
As long as you've been in Texas. Yeah, we're getting close to 20.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So was that like your, when you started working for them, the job you had before that, was it something similar to this?
No, I actually started with McKinsey right out of college.
Oh, wow. So it's been them the whole time.
Yeah. When I first started, I probably didn't intend to stay that long. I always have this thing. I'm going to do the consulting gig for like 2 years, and then I'm going to go out and do something else. And then 2 years in, I felt I still like it very much, and I want to continue for another 2 years. So I've been saying that for the last almost 20 years.
Well, it seems like you're doing all right, and it's been working out. So that's good. And I always think it's cool when people say, "Oh, right out of college, I started working for this company, and I'm still with this company." It shows dedication, loyalty, and the fact that that company is good. So that's pretty cool. I ask this question to everyone on the show. It's usually like the first question I ask. Obviously, when people see someone's title, it's cool and it's long, but they're like, what does that really mean? So like, give us an idea of what your day-to-day work day is like. You know, I'm sure no 2 days are exactly the same, but what's a day look like for you usually?
Yeah, sure. So I focus most of my work on the future of mobility. So right. McKinsey in general serves clients all across the globe on various topics, ranging all the way from strategy to operations improvements and so forth. My particular area, as I said, is around the future of mobility. So whatever is top of mind, usually for the top executives of a company, and they feel they need outside counsel and support in order to get it done, that's when we typically come in and help with it. This could be, in my case, it could be an early stage disruptor that wants to grow and needs support in scaling their business. It could be a large disruptor that wants to venture out and create a new business unit, a new business around the future of mobility. It could be a large incumbent OEM or incumbent automotive company that wants to disrupt itself and thereby sort of disrupt the industry, maybe also build a new future mobility business. And then more recently, we've started to work a lot with what are called the ripple industries. So all of the other industries that are impacted by future mobility trends. So you can think about oil and gas companies that wonder what to do with their gas stations. And should they build charging infrastructure? Or an insurance company that wonders, should I insure robo-taxi fleets in the future? And what are the risks associated with that? It could be a bank that wonders what's going to happen to residual values of electric vehicles. And eventually, if autonomous sort of is being adopted at scale, what is that going to do to residual values of cars? It could be cities that wonder what smart mobility and e-hailing is going to do to congestion and mobility behaviors in the city and which policies they should apply in order to come to the best outcomes of every city. And you can see the list goes on and on. And it might be logistics companies that want to decarbonize and they want to understand how to build charging infrastructure at their depots and whether they should already transition towards electric trucks or electric vans. So as you take a step back, it's almost hard to find an industry that is not impacted by future mobility trends. And That's usually where we come in.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of variables there that you mentioned. You know, and you know, you say future mobility and mobility disruptors. When you say most mobility disruptors, what do you mean by that? Like new companies coming in, like not in just the sense of traditional cars kind of thing, electric cars? Because the word disrupt sounds sometimes bad, but in this sense, it's not.
Yeah, oftentimes we use the word disruption almost, as a synonym for change or rapid change. I think here, when we talk in the automotive or mobility industry about disruption, it's oftentimes around, you know, the transition from ICE vehicles to electric vehicles, or the adoption of ultimately level 4 autonomous driving technologies, where you don't actually have to sit behind the steering wheel. Or when we move away from private car ownership to just using, you know, e-hailing 100% of the time. If you have to go longer distances, you just rent a car. So these are sort of some of the major disruptions we're seeing.
Right. You said something pretty interesting before because you mentioned, does an insurance company, you know, how do they insure a robo-taxi or something? But there's also the aspect of, you know, when vehicles are autonomous, where you have a car, you can drive it, and then you hit a button, and boom, it'll be autonomous. What happens with insurance companies then? Because they need to know if you weren't actually say there was an accident and the car was in autonomous mode, are you at fault or is the manufacturer at fault?
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? That's a pretty interesting concept I've thought about as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you will be surprised. A lot of these questions still haven't fully been figured out yet.
Right.
But
in general, if your car is on autonomous mode and you get in an accident, this is obviously in the future, you shouldn't be held accountable, obviously, because you weren't driving. You know, is that something people should be worried about?
So people should not worry.
So the car, I guess, would record that and you would know that it was in autonomous mode when it happened, or vice versa. If, you know, you just got in a fender bender or whatever, and you were driving, then it's your fault or the other person's fault, whatever it is. But that's an interesting thing for insurance companies to have to deal with, because then it'd be the manufacturer's fault if it was autonomous, not your fault. It's a whole thing. Where are we at with autonomous right now? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of features in cars that have autonomous elements, but I think we're pretty far away from just getting into a car, telling it where to go, and sit back and relax. How far away from that are we? I need an answer.
I've been asked this question for the last 10 years. And
I'm sure.
Look, I think the industry has been going back and forth on this a lot. If you go back to like 2014, 15, 16, I think that's where the initial discussion around sort of level 4 autonomous came up. Level 4 is basically when you don't have to be behind the driver, behind the steering wheel anymore. The car in theory could go by itself. It might not be able to go everywhere. It still might be geofenced in some shape or form. Let's say it's sort of restricted to a city and cannot go outside of the city boundaries. But within that city, it can go basically anywhere. So 2015-16, a lot of people in the industry thought it's going to come relatively soon, and we saw a lot of capital going into the technology. Then I would say a couple of years later, there was a realization that it's more complicated than what people thought. And
there's a lot of variables.
Exactly. then fast forward, we saw a period where people were saying, likely we're going to see it actually in commercial vehicles and trucking first before we see it in past cars.
Right, heard that.
The assumption was, I'm gonna just be on a highway for long haul trucking. There's not that much going on. You usually don't have like a lot of pedestrians or bicyclists, and the maneuvers that the truck has to perform are relatively easy. It's just sort of, you know, acceleration, braking, lane change left and right, and sort of going to the exit lane. That doesn't sound as complicated as driving in New York, in Manhattan. So people thought we're going to see autonomous trucking come first. Now, fast forward to today, I would say that a lot of the, I call them the robo-taxi players. So autonomous vehicles for you and I have made really big advancements in when it comes to that technology. And we're getting very close. I think in to a large part, the safety case has been addressed, and these cars are driving very safely right now, at least from what we've seen so far, in already major cities in the US, like San Francisco. And they're starting to expand. So I think when you think about sort of the second half of the century, this is where I'm expecting to see much more adoption at scale. New cities being unlocked. It's going to be open to more and more of the public to take these robo-taxis. And then it's going to be a question for these players to make sure they can turn their business case profitable. One of the big e-hailing players just came out and published their numbers, and now they are profitable, which is a great sign that you can actually make money with e-hailing. Now, the next step will be for the autonomous robo-taxi players how to do the same and also come to a positive business case.
Yeah. So when you say e-hailing, you're like hailing an electric vehicle taxi?
Yeah, think about sort of the... So first, e-hailing is just sort of think about companies like Didi,
Uber,
Lyft. Yeah, exactly these type of companies. And then eventually you have e-hailing for robo-taxis where it's the same. Use your phone, you call a car, and it picks you up and takes you somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking about the trucking thing, and they thought that'd be coming first because I guess, you know, across the middle America, you know, it's pretty open. So the roads are open, so it's easier for the electric trucks to read the road and see what's going on. But when you think about like New York City or like a robo taxi in New York City, there's so many variables and things and people crossing the street when they're, you know, when it's not even, they don't have the red, they don't have the right of way. They're just crossing the street because it's New York City. And that's what people do. People on bikes and all this stuff. So like the robo taxis would have to be so advanced and be able to, take in like, I guess, I don't know, probably billions of inputs every second to read everything that's going on. I just wonder how that would be or how far away that would we'd be from that. And you said it's pretty close.
Yeah, Look, you can make the argument that Manhattan is still a little crazier than San Francisco, but in San Francisco, we are already seeing these cars drive around, and there's nobody in there. And so far, they have been doing really fine. I don't think necessarily Manhattan is. It's a tough one, so it's probably not the next city where people are going. But in general, you're going to see more and more of an unlock, I would say, in the southern part of the U.S., just because weather conditions. It's still very hard to have a robotaxi fleet operate in heavy snow, for
right,
example.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
So that sort of limits then your business case to the summer months if you're going to a northern city. So that's why you see a lot of the robotaxi players sort of prioritize the southern cities first.
Now, the robotaxi players, who are they? Are they private companies? Are they large, OEMs? Like who's making these? And in San Francisco, are they basically just around the city? They're not really going on highways and stuff yet, or are they?
So they can go on highways. So that's possible. Who's behind them? I mean, just to name one or two, obviously the big ones probably are Waymo, owned by Alphabet, and then Cruise, which obviously is closely affiliated with GM. Mm. So those are two of the names that we're seeing already sort of being operational in San Francisco.
Yeah. Wow. That's cool stuff. That's like future stuff. Is there anywhere in Texas that this has been implemented?
It's a good question. Actually, I think Cruise came out and announced Houston, and then Waymo came out, I think, last week and announced that they will start operations in Austin. So, yes, it's coming to Texas as well.
Yeah, cool. I like Austin. I was just in Austin a couple months ago. Been there a few times. Wow, yeah. So, and all these cars, I mean, it kind of goes without saying that they would be electric, right? They'd be EVs. You know, there'll be no combustion engines, or would they? I don't know.
No, I think the idea is to have them be electric vehicles. That's for sure, because you do want to do actually solve for two things when you think about sort of the purpose and what people are trying to do when it comes to mobility. I think there's like two or three really big themes and nuts we are trying to crack here. One is, still in the U.S. we have 40,000 fatal car accidents every year. Mm-hmm. And the biggest drivers of that are still, intoxicated driving, speeding, and distracted driving because people look at their phones when they're driving.
Yeah, human error.
Yeah. And you would say a robotaxi is not doing any of these three. So hopefully, robotaxis will actually have an autonomous vehicles help us to drive down that number. The other aspect is, 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. are basically driven by transportation. And by moving towards electric, that's certainly going to help. And then lastly, on average, I think in the U.S., we're spending right around an hour per day in the car. Now, are there ways where, let's say you're in a robo-taxi, at least you can use that time for other things, right, that are more value adding to you? You might be able to work. You might be able to watch videos or movies or just to sleep, but to do something different than just sitting behind the wheel in a traffic jam.
Right. Yeah, so, that's the worst.
So, and then when you think about it, also autonomous cars can not only be used to transport people, they can also be used to transport goods, right?
Sure.
So
sure.
Certainly there's a future where a lot of your grocery shopping can be done obviously online, and then it's being delivered by a robotaxi to your home, which also helps you to bring down the 1 hour per day that you're spending in a car. So it's all about freeing up that time and giving it back to the people so they can use it for things that are more important to them. I have two kids and I would really like to spend more time with them, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love driving. I'm a car guy. Are you a car guy? Are you
a car? 100%.
Yeah. So I'm assuming you still like to get into a car with an engine and it has gears and you change gears and drive. I mean, I do, but I think everyone eventually down the line will probably have both, you know, or way down the line, not have both. But I, in my lifetime, you know, I'd always want at least something with an engine that makes a noise and is like, you know, that's just me. Do you drive an electric car? Do you have an electric car?
I do have an ICE car and I do have an electric car. And for my daily commute, like when I go from our home to my office, I usually take the electric car. It's very convenient, and then
I
basically treat it like my phone, right? You use it during the day and then you charge it overnight. And I tried to compare the cost of it. It's roughly a fourth, right? What I'm spending, if I take the ICE car, what I'm spending on gasoline compared to what I'm spending in electricity on the electric car.
So
you're saving money and you're doing something good for the environment. And I like the combination of the two.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I always, you know, if you live in a city and you commute to work where you have to drive and it's not that far, electric vehicle is the way to go because you're just back and forth. You're not, you know, you don't have to worry about gas or anything like that. But yeah, that's definitely, it's always funny when I talk to people on here and they say ICE car. You know, internal combustion engine. It's just funny, like that. what it's called. What is your ICE car?
Well, you know, being a Texan, obviously, I need to have a pickup truck.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. And they're convenient. I mean, pickup trucks are very convenient to have, except when friends ask you to help them move.
Yeah, exactly.
It makes sense. You're in Texas, and Texas is very big. You got to get around, and sometimes you might not be able to charge somewhere if you're going far, so you got to use the ICE car. Where are we with, so you said robo taxis, what about robo flight,
like eVTOL,
like a flying taxi basically?
Yeah,
but no pilot.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's already hard enough to talk about adoption of robo-taxis and when they're going to become relevant at scale. I think for flying vehicles, it's even harder. Just because, obviously, as a robo-taxi, when you don't know what to do, you can, at least if you're operating within a city, you can just stop, right? And then sit at the side of the road and try to figure out kind of what needs to happen next. It's not that easy to do it in the air.
you can't just stop.
Yeah. So that's certainly a challenge. Obviously, regulation is very, very strict when it comes to everything aviation. So we will have to work through that before a lot of these, you know, future vehicles are going to be approved. Now, at the same time, some people would argue things are easier in the air because you don't have as much other traffic participants. You don't have bicyclists. You don't have
anything.
And if you directly establish a technology where all of these vehicles can and must communicate with each other and they're aware of each other's positioning, that should make things easier. So there's something to be said in favor of air mobility or autonomous flying taxis. But I think this is still quite futuristic and will take a few more years to come out.
Yeah, definitely. Sure. But it could be really cool, you know, especially like you're in New York City, you just go to the roof of your building and it comes and picks you up like on a helicopter pad type thing. Or like you're at an airport. I did read somewhere that something in Chicago, they were going to try doing this where you would get into an automated robo taxi from Chicago airport to take you wherever you were going in Chicago, like land on a top of a building or something, like within the next few years or something. I mean, I could be wrong. I thought I saw that, but it's pretty interesting how all this, you know, the electric vehicles in every aspect are really changing things. You know, whether it's a scooter, whether it's a electric motorcycle, electric bike, electric car, and the technology is getting better and better and how they charge them. Yeah. You know, I've said this on the show a million times. Once you can charge a car as fast as it takes you to fill up your gas tank, then, you know, that's a game changer. You know, it's like, especially if the infrastructure is there for it, where you have charging stations almost as often as gas stations. I mean, that's when you'll probably see a huge switch. Because right now, EVs are what, maybe 10% of the market?
Yeah, I think we are, the latest sales numbers, top of my head, would be right around 7% in the US of new vehicle sales are electric.
Oh, okay.
Roughly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's about the ballpark. We would say by 2030, that's going to get closer to the 40 to 50% range.
So by 2030, you said?
By 2030, yes.
Oh, wow, that's not far away. That's a big number, 50%.
Yeah, of the vehicle sales, right? That doesn't mean that 50% of the cars driving around are electric. I think by then it's maybe somewhere between 12 to 14% of the car park. So basically the vehicles that we see out on the roads are going to be electrified. Mm-hmm. But yeah, 40 to 50% is our current estimate, given all of the regulation and customer interest that we're seeing.
Interesting time, because you think about like 2020 with the pandemic and everything, and by 2030, just in 10 years, what has happened and what will change. Yes. And that's really quick. And it's really cool. It's very futuristic, you know. But I wanted to mention this before we get going. You have a podcast as well, right? Called Drivers of Disruption. I wanted to make sure I plug that.
Yeah, that's great. The McKinsey Center for Future Mobility, we typically interview leaders in the industry on a frequent basis and ask them about sort of their major challenges that they're facing while disrupting the mobility space. So whoever is interested in listening into that, find us on our website, McKinsey.com, or on the McKinsey Center for Future Mobility website.
Yeah, and then probably they can get it just like this podcast and on all the podcast platforms,
exactly.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Philip Kampshoff, this has been really, really cool. You know, it's always interesting talking to someone who's, and just your title's cool, you know, the future mobilities and all that stuff. It's the future, and it's cool to talk to someone who knows all about this stuff. Anything else you'd like to say before we get going?
No, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me, and hopefully people are equally excited about sort of what's in the future here. And as I said, a lot of these trends are going to help for better lives, less fatal accidents, more time to spend with your families, and ultimately less emissions. So let's all chime in and try to celebrate this disruption as quick as possible.
Yeah, celebrate disruptions in a good way. Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely. Well, Philip, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
You got it. That was Dr. Philip Kampshoff, the senior partner at McKinsey & Company and co-founder of the McKinsey Center for Future Mobilities. For more information about them, head to McKinsey.com. And as we mentioned just before, check out Philip's podcast called Drivers of Disruption. That's the good disruption, of course. But that will do it for this episode of DNT. Make sure you follow us on social media at Dealer News Today. I am your host, Derek D, DerekD.com, for all my stuff. Appreciate you listening, everybody. So until next time, this is Dealer News Today.